As the Supreme Court battle rages, no one is under heavier scrutiny or facing more pressure than Senator Charles Grassley. This hour, how each party sees the standoff. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stephen Schmidt and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University join us this hour with their analysis. In addition to the Supreme Court battle, we'll also talk about where the Democratic nomination race is now after Bernie Sanders wins five back-to-back states. All three remaining GOP candidates back off their pledges to support the eventual GOP nominee for president, and what we've learned about the worldview of Donald Trump. Join our discussion for this Politics Wednesday. First, this news. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, two esteemed professors from Iowa State University joining us in our Ames studio. Stephen Schmidt is with us, University Professor of Political Science at ISU, and Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at ISU. Jim, Stephen, always great to have you as a tandem in the studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
This hour, we want to talk most of the first half hour, if not all of it, about the Supreme Court controversy, then get, of course, to the 2016 presidential race, and also some items of foreign policy, including what we've learned about how Donald Trump sees the world in his comments after the Brussels attack. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Initially, as said, join us with your thoughts on the Supreme Court controversy over filling the place left by the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Gentlemen, appears some small cracks appearing in the Republican Supreme Court blockade. Senators return from their recess next week. The White House is likely to press even harder when they do. The Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, will have met 10 senators as of today. The White House looking to schedule many more senators, including Republicans who've said they publicly that they'll see the judge once they're back from the two-week break, which they are next week. And no one is under heavier scrutiny or facing more pressure than Iowa's Senator Charles Grassley as head of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And, of course, this whole thing has become a major part of the 2016 race for the White House. Here's Hillary Clinton in a speech at Madison, Wisconsin a few days ago, blasting our Senator Chuck Grassley for blocking the vote.
And now Republicans in the Senate are acting like our votes didn't count and that President Obama is not still our nation's leader. Now, I'll tell you, those are not high-minded principles. They are low-minded politics. And today, I'm adding my voice to the chorus, asking Senator Grassley to step up and do his job. He should. He should hold a hearing, and he should schedule it as soon as the Senate returns from recess.
Okay, well, let's hear what Senator Grassley has to say in his own defense. He holds a weekly news call with Iowa reporters, and he was asked this week about his role in the controversy over President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. This is a somewhat extended clip to give us some good insights as to the justification that Senator Grassley puts forth here. Let's listen closely.
Matt Kelly at Radio Iowa, Senator. I'll have a follow-up for you as well. You've said you want voters to have a voice in choosing the next Supreme Court justice. In Wisconsin yesterday, Hillary Clinton said you're ignoring the 65 million Americans who voted in 2012 to make Barack Obama president. Would you say that the 2016 voters are more important than the 2012 voters?
The 2014 vote is very much a part of this. Not only because I say so, but based upon what President Obama said about the 2014 election. Yeah, the president was reelected, but the president also said when we had the biggest changeover in the United States Senate since the 1980 election, that that election was a referendum on his program. So there's a whole new Senate that has a mandate from the grassroots of America to be a check on the presidency. And the president can appoint, but the White House can consent or not consent or withhold consent. So the president's doing what he thinks he has an electoral mandate to do. The United States Senate is doing what it has an electoral mandate to do, and that is to withhold and let the people have a voice based upon not some Republican determination that that's what we ought to do at this time in history. It's based upon what a lot of Democratic senators have said in like situations when we had a Republican president. So you can't have one rule for Republican presidents, another rule for Democrat presidents, and this brings some uniformity to our approach. Besides, I would look at Hillary Clinton's statement as a person who very dramatically lost primaries in three states. She's up for investigation under email. She's going to be possibly questioned by the FBI, and she wants to take attention away from her political troubles and put the focus someplace else. So she has chose Chuck Grassley for that focus.
Okay, Senator Grassley on a weekly news call with Iowa Reporters, a portion of it talking about the Supreme Court controversy. You can weigh in on that as we discuss it this first half hour, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Stephen Schmidt. First of all, you've heard the reasons there from Senator Grassley for some plenty of criticism in the press for Senator Grassley, also for other Senate Republicans here. How does this shake out for you, the reasoning?
Well, this is a very intense political year. And, you know, the Republicans are saying that, you know, they're being strict constitutionalists and that this is a matter of principle and of procedure. But, it's odd to say that when you have a president of one party and a Senate of a different party, the Senate should block the appointments of the president who is, you know, in the White House. I mean, if that were to happen, we would never have any appointments, because very often you have divided government with the Senate in one hand and the White House in another hand.
But what Senator Grassley just said is a little more nuanced than that, isn't it? He said the 2014 was a referendum on the Obama presidency, and it really did create some significant changes in the Senate. So he feels the new Senate has a mandate to do what it's doing.
Well, it wasn't a referendum on Obama. It was a referendum on Democratic House and Senate members.
Well, Obama said it was a referendum. He admitted in an interview, didn't he, that it was a referendum. But anyway, go on. Sorry.
Then Obama will go down in history as one of the dumbest presidents, you know, ever, because and I remember that he said that, and I know that he regrets it every morning when he wakes up. He says to Michelle, that was the dumbest thing I could have ever said, because that sealed my fate as a president, giving the Republicans in the House and Senate basically the legitimacy to block everything that I want to do, because that's what a referendum is. Mm-hmm. I mean, Obama has made the bed that he is lying in to some extent, because he has been such a terrible communicator. He doesn't go down to the House or Senate. He doesn't have schmoozy get-together events. He is not like Lyndon Johnson, someone who can make deals with members of Congress. And so he has very little communication, even with Democrats in the House and Senate. And I think that's why we've ended up in this terrible impasse, or one reason we've ended up in this terrible impasse.
Let's hear from Jim McCormick. Your thoughts here. What are we likely to see this week when the Senate members return to face the White House?
I think there will be some members that will meet with Judge Garland here. Many of those are really driven not by sort of Senate rules and constitutional requirements, but they're really driven by their political standing back home. I mean, you know, the litany of Republican senators that have indicated that they, in fact, might meet are senators that are really in difficult races. I mean, I think the one exception to this that immediately comes to mind is Senator Johnson from Wisconsin. He has been pretty adamant, even though he's actually behind in the polls in Wisconsin against the former senator Russ Feingold, who he actually defeated in the 2010 election. So I think there will be some members that will meet. I think that that will be the limitation of it in terms of what really will be done. I can't imagine the Republicans, after making all of these statements about no hearings, I mean, this would be a coup d'etat, it seems to me, on Mitch McConnell if, in fact, hearings were to proceed here. So I think what you'll have is an extended kind of dragging out the meeting with these senators. That's actually plays to Democratic advantage, it seems to me, because they keep it on the front page here. And so that probably is not something that they would be very unhappy with, to extend it into the summer. I think the one thing that sort of clashes with this, as I was thinking about this today coming in, is that if there is sort of something released with regard to Senator Clinton or Secretary Clinton in terms of the email scandals, mm-hmm. we will have these kind of clashing political interests in the media. It will be actually quite entertaining, but also quite saddening in terms of the political process here. But that's what I foresee. I do not see the Republicans backing down. I can't imagine, given the other kind of fissures already within the Republican Party, where they need another fissure over whether they're sort of the Washington establishment and giving in to the Democratic administration.
Back to your point, though, about there are some fissures, some cracks there appearing. One of those from a Republican senator from Maine in I think, a healthy or competitive battle for reelection coming up. Susan Collins speaking out this week, saying that there are no limits on a president appointing nominees to the court, and that she has reread the Constitution to make sure she understands the exact wording.
From my perspective, we ought to follow the Constitution. It's clearly within the president's right, indeed its obligation, to send to the Senate a nominee. And then we have our duty to either consent or withhold our consent. That's the normal order, and that's the way I think we ought to proceed.
Okay, so we have here Susan Collins breaking ranks in the Republicans. Stefan, let me ask you this. Is just acknowledged that Senate Republicans in very competitive states facing reelection may be allowed to break ranks and forgiven for it?
Oh, they have to break ranks. And look, let me put it this way. There is no discipline in the Senate. I mean, just look at who's running for president right up there. Ted Cruz, he never followed any rules in the Senate. The senators are very, very independent. They're not like House members. The House is very disciplined because the rules are so tight. In the Senate, every senator is very much a free agent and can do a lot of things. And these senators, I'm a resident of New Hampshire as well as Iowa. Kelly Ayotte is up for reelection. She's a Republican. She is scared to death what will happen because public opinion in the United States generally says that the Senate should hold hearings. 53%, I think, of Americans in the last poll I saw think that, there should be, these hearings. And a vast majority of Americans in polls have said they think that this is more about politics than it is about the Constitution and procedure. And so I think that this is a very short-sighted decision on the part of the Republicans because if this results in them losing control in the Senate, because there are about six senators, I think, maybe Jim McCormick is motioning seven. these are not exact numbers, but McCormick is better than I am at that, who are in basically states that Obama won, where normally, a Republican would have a harder road to hoe to get elected. Those senators are extremely nervous. And if this thing drags out and becomes essentially a highly partisan political spectacle and they lose, or some of them lose, and the majority goes back to the Democrats, everything that the Republicans are trying to achieve right now in terms of holding the line so that they can, you know, basically get another conservative in the Supreme Court will be at risk. So it's a game basically of chicken, you know, where the cars are racing towards each other very fast. And I don't know if I agree with Jim McCormick or not, but I think if the Republicans see that this is going to be humongously dangerous for them, they may find some good excuse, you know, a rule or something that will allow them to have hearings, and then they can vote Garland down, the nominee down. I mean, they don't have to vote him up or down. They can vote him down and say, well, you know, he didn't pass some of the scrutiny, and, you know, it's a different time from the last time that we voted for him. There are many, many ways that politicians can change their mind. And I think even these stalwart Republicans like Mitch McConnell, they can change their mind.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Schmidt with us of Iowa State University. Jim McCormick as well from Iowa State University, our political analyst on this Politics Wednesday. Weigh in with us on this Supreme Court controversy with your comments, your questions. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to the phones for a call or two. John in Ankeny, what point do you want to make or question do you have? John, welcome.
Yeah, good morning. Glad to be here. I was wondering if the good professors could comment on Senator Grassley. First of all, I'm ticked at him because he's exactly why people are going for Trump, because he refuses to, you know, play the game. He gets stubborn like this. He's not doing the country's business. The second point was, and this is what I really like him to comment on, is why he's holding more or less secret meetings with constituents. You know, an organization knows about it, but they're not supposed to publicize where he's going to be, and his staff is not publicizing where he's going to be. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, John and Ankeny, I don't know if that's quite the characterization that the Grassley people would have of it. I think they had a number of town hall meetings. These happen to be mostly, if not all, in northwest Iowa. Jim McCormick?
Yes, I think he's had three town hall meetings, and I've heard in the same period, so previously he would have, in this kind of break period, he would have four town hall meetings. So, you know, he's got 75% of those town hall meetings, and you're right, they have been presumably, they have been in areas that are very, very friendly to Senator Grassley in the western part and northwestern part of the state.
That's to be expected in this climate.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he acts, after all, he's running for re-election. He's a political, he's a politician. He's a political animal here. And so I'm not really stunned about that. I just wanted to throw in one other thing from the earlier discussion from Senator Collins. You know, it does say in the Constitution that the Senate, has the right to advise and consent. But the issue here is, and I think it's been pointed out and it should be put on the table here, is that there's no time frame. It doesn't say it doesn't even use the felicitous phrase in a lot of legislation in a timely fashion. It says nothing about the timing of when this has to be done here. So I think the Senate has a role and the president has a role and each can exercise their role. But it doesn't say anything about the time frame.
What about the interpretation of it to withhold consent, not saying yes or no, but just not doing anything? Is that an interpretation one can reasonably pull from the Constitution?
Well, I mean, if in fact the session expires by the time that they get around to it, I guess that would comport with the Constitution. After all, as you know, and let me just be sort of on the defensive here a little bit, the president can use interim appointments to get people that he cannot get appointed through the Senate, and presidents all the time use that, as has President Obama. Doesn't apply to the Supreme Court, I'll grant you, but nonetheless, you know, there is this kind of back and forth, this kind of chicken game between these two branches is not something that is particularly new over the Garland nomination.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dan in Des Moines. Dan, joining our conversation as we talk about the Supreme Court controversy, filling that ninth seat. Dan, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yes, thank you. You guys do some great work and some great questions. I'm hoping to add to that.
Well, thank you very much, Dan.
If the reason for holding up the nomination is because the people should have a voice, then what I question is, then what about Donald Trump? He has votes. He's won states. He's winning delegates. If the concern is that people should have a voice, then I suppose the Republican Party should stand aside and let him be the nominee if that's what the people are choosing. Why are we having this double standard?
That's an interesting point. Stefan, do you want to pick that up?
Well, you know, that is the big debate, and that's a good, concise way of putting it. I mean, the Republican Party has its own idea of who they want and are not very happy with either of the two front runners, as you know. I mean, Donald Trump is the least favored, and Ted Cruz, by virtue of his having been such a nasty senator and attacked the leadership of the party, is also not high on the list. So I guess the people have a different idea of what they want as their representation. But, you know, I guess with Jim McCormick's comment, I would add that if you go back, the Constitution may not say anything, but history says how long it should take for a president to nominate someone and the Senate to at least have hearings. And what the Republicans are suggesting is unprecedented. It's never happened. There's never been a complete blockage of holding any hearings for the foreseeable future of that president's term in office, which is what Mitch McConnell has said. We are not going to hold hearings until a new president is sworn in. I mean, I think the founding fathers would say, well, OK, so what if this had happened? Scalia had died a year ago and you still had 2 years in Obama's term. Would the Republicans then be OK in saying we're not going to have any hearings for any Obama appointment, even though he still has 2 years in office? Because he still has, you know, almost a year. So I think you know, that's the measure. The measure is that it is something that is not normally done.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, also this week, I think yesterday, Senator Grassley said that the Republican Senate will not confirm a justice to the Supreme Court this year, even if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency in November during that lame duck period between the election and the end of the year. So that's interesting, too. Do we not, Jim McCormick, have a possible scenario where Hillary Clinton wins the presidency and then next year she could nominate an even less moderate justice than Merrick?
I think that is entirely the possibility here. And it's, I suppose, on the Republican part.
Merrick Garland.
It's a gamble. Yeah, Justice Garland.
I've used his first name. Forgive me.
Yeah.
Alone.
And I think that's entirely possible. And I think that's sort of the gamble. But, you know, if they're in fact, if the Republicans are standing on this principle, you know, that the Senate has the right to, you know, advise and consent. You know, they have to sort of live with that outcome. So I don't think there'll be a lame duck appointment has speculated. And Senator McConnell, of course, has said that that will not happen either. And of course, in large measure, in terms of bringing things to the floor, Senator McConnell, as leader of the party, would in the Senate would have that prerogatives here. So I think that that's entirely possible that if Hillary Clinton were to win, that, you know, she could appoint somebody else. I mean, certainly
so you could
Judge Garland would be disappointed, but then, I suspect.
But potentially two shots in the foot of the GOP. One, they could potentially lose the Senate over this. And two, they might get a justice who is less moderate than Merrick Garland. Potentially.
It's possible, but it's potentially two shots there to the Republicans. But I think that you know, some of these senators that are up for re-election are obviously playing it very coyly in terms of at least meeting with Judge Garland here.
Okay. Jim McCormick with it, professor of political science at Iowa State University, along with Stefan Schmidt, a university professor of political science at ISU. We hope you'll join our conversation as we talk about this a little bit more, but also dovetail into the 2016 presidential race. Bernie Sanders having won three states on Saturday. He's on a roll. We'll talk about the situation in the Democrat side and the GOP side with the nomination race after we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Jim McCormick and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. We hope you'll join our conversation as we talk politics. We like to do that on Wednesdays. And, of course, the recent Wednesdays have given us plenty to talk about, including this Wednesday and the Wednesdays on up into election in November, guaranteed. Let's talk about the 2016 presidential race shifting topics, as we talked in the first half hour about the Supreme Court controversy filling that ninth seat Let's talk about the Democratic race. First of all, Bernie Sanders winning in three states this past Saturday. Big victories in Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington. That was after carrying Idaho and Utah earlier in the week. He's now cut into Hillary Clinton's delegate lead. Stephen Schmidt, where do you see the Democratic race going from here?
Recently, I heard a very, very brilliant commentator say, you know, it's going to be very hard for Bernie Sanders to actually get enough delegates to get the nomination. He would have to do what Barack Obama did in 2008. I almost fell off my chair and started laughing because clearly there is an opportunity to do this by going long and doing very well in big delegate states, and the odds are against him, but it's not impossible. And the momentum that he has is so unbelievable, the enthusiasm for him, the discussion that goes on almost every day on almost every medium I can think of the enthusiasm deficit that Hillary Clinton's campaign has, and the continued troubling drip, drip, drip of emails of 100 and some FBI agents on the case of the Hillary Clinton emails, the article, extensive article in the Washington Post that reconstructed a lot of problems that Hillary Clinton had with using her BlackBerry in areas in the State Department where no devices are permitted, and she insisted on taking her BlackBerry into those areas. The security system said those BlackBerries can be turned into microphones if they're hacked by the Chinese or others, and so we don't allow anyone to bring their devices in. It's a troubling story, mm-hmm. and it doesn't go away. It continues. On the other hand, I think probably Hillary Clinton is going to overcome all this, and the Republicans are making it so much easier by having one of the worst election seasons in my lifetime. And maybe historically that it'll go down as one of the strangest and most self-destructive in history. So, you know, it is a very, very strange year. And I think Bernie Sanders is the only one of all the people running, except Kasich, who has no chance at all, who has very high favorability ratings and trust. People say Bernie Sanders doesn't have any hidden, you know, things in the closet, skeletons, and is trusted and says, you know, what he thinks and sticks with that, doesn't waffle and doesn't wobble. So that's interesting.
Yeah, let's listen to him in his own words. Last week on CBS's Face the Nation, Bernie Sanders pointed out that polls show him doing better against a possible Donald Trump nomination than Secretary Clinton.
We think that the path forward is a pretty good path for us. Clearly, Secretary Clinton did very, very well in the Deep South, not a strong area for us. But I think as we go forward, you're going to see us doing better and better. And by the way, I think people are also going to appreciate when they look at the polls that Bernie Sanders does better against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton does. In fact, in the last NBC poll, we were 18 points ahead of Donald Trump, far more so than Secretary Clinton.
Now, Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign insists it is just a month away from locking up the Democratic nomination. And Sanders campaign, however, says has vowed to fight through July. Sanders now arguing also that superdelegates, these are the party officials with votes at the convention who are now presently allied with Clinton, can be convinced to change sides. Jim McCormick, is this a possible scenario? You see that big swing because the numbers that we're looking at with Hillary Clinton several hundred ahead include those superdelegates, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, she's got about 1,700 delegates at the last count that I saw, and he's just under 1,000 delegates, 900 and change, very close to 1,000. And some of her and the actual delegate, one delegate margin, I think, is in the 200 to 295 range between Sanders and Clinton. So those superdelegates are very pivotal. And a couple of the primaries coming up here. I mean, you think about the Wisconsin primary in a week's time, and then the New York primary in a couple of weeks' time. You know, and there would be delegate-rich numbers if Bernie Sanders were successful in those, and he could close that delegate one gap And then it would put, it seems to me, put additional pressure on the superdelegates. I think there's an interesting kind of comparison here between the Democrats and the Republicans, because the Republicans, of course, are very, very anxious, at least the Republican National Committee, in terms of whether Trump would get it. But they don't have the same kind of control, if you will, that the Democrats have with these superdelegates, so that the superdelegates really can have the party elites continue to select the nominee. And that's much more of a problem, a much more difficult task, it seems, for the Republicans. So that's an interesting kind of comparison. I mean, you might think that the Democrats would be more in terms of small-d democracy within their party selection, but it actually turns out, at least the way things are structured now, that the party elites could have have more say. I guess to answer your question directly, and I'm sorry to go on, but I think that the superdelegates would be unlikely to change, because I think there's a fearfulness of a Bernie Sanders nomination in terms of who he could attract, whether the support that he has among young people would actually turn out in the general election.
A fearfulness of having passionate followers, young people?
I think so, because they might not vote. They might not vote in the general election. They would, let me put it differently, they would not vote at the same rate as some of the other segments of the population.
Mm. Okay. And Stefan talked about the drip, drip, drip of the email controversy. Do you think that will what are your thoughts on that and how that will impact the rest of this nomination race and possibly the general election race?
Yeah, Stefan did put me onto that piece about it in the Washington Post, and I was sort of surprised to see that there are 147 FBI agents involved in this investigation. That's really remarkable in light of the kind of terrorist threats that we see, in terms of diverting scarce resources in another direction here. So I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but I think that though, even if there's not a legal outcome, there's going to be a political fallout from this, because once we start getting some of the details of this, there'll be more and more kind of leaking of this. It'd be interesting to see, in light of our last segment, how this issue is treated versus sort of the Supreme Court nomination in terms of the kind of media coverage that's given to it.
I think the fallout has already occurred. I mean, Hillary Clinton started with 70% approval. And Hillary Clinton has shrunk and declined, and Bernie Sanders has risen and grown. And so I think, this story doesn't seem to want to go away. They've now, offered amnesty or immunity, I should say, to the main person.
Now, amnesty is another issue, Stefan.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think of it as amnesty, believe me, because this guy who was Hillary Clinton's staff person and whom she got the State Department to appoint to the State Department, which is an incredibly unusual thing, apparently. This was a basically someone who built a server at their house and was basically a Clinton person. He knows a lot, and everyone is very anxious to know why they gave him immunity. I mean, he must know some things that where he could be charged with something. And, it's just not good when you're running for president to constantly have programs like this one talking about the emails. And, we've been talking about this for months.
Right. Let's switch over to the GOP columnist. Our hour dwindles here. Last night on CNN, town hall meeting, interestingly, none of the three remaining Republican presidential candidates, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, John Kasich, none of them would guarantee that they would support the eventual GOP nominee for president, a departure from previous vows to do so. Jim McCormick, another sign the party is splitting?
Fissures in the Republican Party are rampantly the fissure is getting wider and wider, I guess is what I should say here. I was really surprised that all of them came out with this position here. I mean, obviously, part of it is to sort of the Stop Trump movement here. But I think that it makes, in my view, the nomination of the coming out of the Republican convention not very valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stefan, what do you see in this contested likely, I guess, can we say likely or possible contested GOP convention?
Well, I think so. And I know for a fact that the, Republican leadership of the, the Republican National Committee and elites and others and the Jeb Bush people and so on are, trying to figure out how they can make that an event that does not fatally implode the party, because obviously if Donald Trump has a lot of delegates, and he has said this, and then it goes to someone else, the people that Donald Trump has attracted to voting are not kind to establishment maneuvers, even though the line is always, well, these are the rules of the Republican Party, and we don't really, you know, care what the voters think. These are the rules, and, you know, whatever happens at the Republican National Convention will be legal, because the Republican committee that does the rules for each convention is a legitimate body. This is not controlled by the U.S. Constitution. We can do whatever we want. We're like a golf club. You know, we can pass all kinds of rules on what you can wear and so on. And I think that would be absolutely a disaster. And so, you know, we're all, I think, very nervous about what's going to happen at that convention, because it could become not just politically but physically ugly, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the front runner, Donald Trump's foreign policy. He said many provocative things about foreign policy in the past few weeks in the wake of the attacks on Brussels. He has been saying that, for instance, NATO is obsolete. He spoke with Fox News over the weekend. Here's a little bit about what he had to say in foreign policy.
We need to either transition into terror, or we need something else, because we have to get countries together. You see what happened with Brussels, where they had absolutely no intelligence of having to do with people living in their own country. They have no coordination with other countries. There's zero coordination that they had with other countries. And it was ridiculous. I mean, I knew more about Brussels than Brussels knew. I was the one that predicted this was going to happen in Brussels, and was criticized by the New York Times for it, and now everybody's saying I was right all over Twitter. So, I mean, you know, we need to modernize NATO, at a minimum modernize it, but certainly we shouldn't be paying for the kind of it. We're paying disproportionately so much, and we're a nation that owes $19 trillion, and we just can't keep doing this.
Okay, what have we learned about Donald Trump's worldview? I want to ask you both about that, especially because of the foreign policy expertise we have among you two, between you two gentlemen. Donald Trump saying the U.S. should rethink its involvement in NATO because that defense alliance costs too much money. Jim McCormick, these and other statements in the last few days, what are you thinking?
Well, NATO has really been the most successful alliance structure that the United States has. It's been the core of our foreign policy since the end of World War II. It has gone under some revisions really since both the end of the Cold War, but even before the end of the Cold War, and even after 9/11, they have gone to enlarge and change their mission. So I think that Mr. Trump here is really off base in terms of his critique of the NATO alliance. It has been sort of the bulwark of American foreign policy.
So many other.
It is true that that the United States pays more of the expense for NATO, and you know that we have constantly prodded the Europeans to pay, you know, at least 2% of their GNP or GDP on defense, and that has been hard for the member countries to reach. There's only been a few of them that have reached that. So. You know, that sort of criticism is not, you know, not off the mark. But the work that NATO has done either within Europe or beyond is, I think, is crucial to American security.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Cuba. Stefan, you weren't with us last week. Jim was with us last week. On Monday, Fidel Castro responded to President Obama's historic trip last week to Cuba in a long letter recounting the history of U.S. aggression against Cuba, writing, "We don't need the empire to give us any presence." And that was Fidel Castro's first response to that three-day visit last week, in which Obama said he had come to bury the two countries' historic Cold War hostility. Obama did not meet with Fidel Castro, but met with his younger brother, Raul Castro. Your view on the historic visit?
Well, it was a historic visit. I mean, you know, this was amazing. Usually you would expect a conservative president who has great conservative credentials and is secure to go and open up a communist country like China, you know, Nixon. Here you have a liberal president and a Democrat going and saying, well, you know, the Republicans are the majority, they're against all this, but it's been 55 years and this hasn't worked, and it's 90 miles off our shore, and it's poisoned our relationship with the rest of Latin America for the last 55 years. I mean, this is amazing. And so he does it. And of course, there are many things that still need to be done, and Cuba is a poor country, and Dr. McCormick and I were talking about this on our way over here, that probably, you know, they're not going to be writing a lot of checks to buy a lot of American products, but it is an opening that I think can't be closed. I mean, can you imagine an American president getting elected and shutting the relationship down again? The business community in the United States, the tourism industry, the airlines, the IT industry, cell phone industry, entertainment industry, you know, they all are delighted to be able to add Cuba to their list of business projects and opportunities. So
you see it as irreversible regardless of who.
Of course it is. Yeah. Absolutely irreversible. I mean, you know, the approval rating for opening to Cuba in public opinion polls is huge. Americans think, you know, it didn't work, and, you know, Cuba is no longer a big threat. And yes, you know, we do a lot of business with countries that had many, many more prisoners in jail and horrible human rights records, much worse than Cuba. And so it's kind of silly to say that that's why we're not going to have the relationship. Fidel Castro writing this blistering letter, the Cubans are very nice to people, you know, who you know, are elderly and, you know, are in nursing homes. And so I can understand that. And Fidel Castro is a tough guy, and he will never give up. And he wants the Cubans to remember that the United States has, you know, invaded Cuba many times and occupied it and ran it. And he got his little licks in there. But I don't think Raul is interested in having that be the policy of Cuba. And certainly the next generation of Cuban leaders who are, you know, they're younger. They came after the revolution. I think, you know, they think you can do business with the United States. I mean, if China can do business with the United States, you know, maybe Cuba can as well. Mm-hmm.
And finally today, Jim McCormick, I wanted to get your view on the horrific bombing we heard about in Pakistan. And now Pakistan deciding to launch a paramilitary crackdown against Islamist militants in that province of Punjab. This is after the Easter Day bombing, killing 70 people in the provincial capital, Lahore. It was at a public park, responsibility claimed by the Pakistani Taliban's faction there, declaring, I guess it's declared loyalty to the Islamic State. The group said it was targeting Christians, at least 29 children enjoying an Easter weekend out there among those killed. And this is interesting, too, bringing to light the fact that even though Pakistan is a majority Muslim state, there is a large Christian population there. So, Jim, the question for you, what is the Taliban hoping to accomplish by slaughtering women and children at a park?
Well, I think one of the things that they hope to accomplish, of course, is their continuing relevance. And, of course, their concern about the Pakistani government. I mean, they have always been at loggerheads with the Pakistani government, and they certainly do not want the Pakistani forces to crack down on, you know, sort of the Waziristan and so on further. But I think it's also part of this larger picture, unfortunately, of to show ISIS and their affiliates and their allies or associates of their a power around the world here. After all, if you look at the numbers, the number of people killed in Pakistan in that bombing on Easter Sunday, you know, sort of the holiest day in the Christian calendar here, actually more people were killed there than in Brussels. I'm not diminishing either side, and the number of people injured was also greater. But yet we don't see the same kind of response, if you will, or outrage here. And even it took the State Department a day or so to talk about that this was an attack upon Christians here. So the sectarianism has spread not just between Sunni and Shia, but also with regard to Christians.
Well, yeah,
as well.
And President Obama still doesn't want to talk about Islamic radicalism. You know, he wants to leave the word Islamic out of it and say that it's just terrorists. And he is getting, frankly, beaten up pretty badly by the Republicans, and I think generally by others who think that it is crucial to note that this is, you know, it's not Norwegian Lutherans who are carrying out these acts. And you know, I think this is where we're stuck with this whole issue of religion.
Mm-hmm. But when we have a terror incident that is launched by a Christian fundamentalist, let's say, do we necessarily categorize it and start calling it Christian fanaticism, Stefan?
If it is intended to produce a Christian caliphate and there is a clear policy to go after other religions and establish an empire based on a certain religion, then yes, we should always mention it, because this isn't just a bunch of Muslims randomly doing this. There is, in fact, and Obama, again, doesn't want to talk about that. ISIS and extremist radical Islamists have a plan to create a caliphate. That's no longer fiction, and it's no longer something that just Rush Limbaugh talks about. But it's difficult to talk about because so many Muslims are our friends and our neighbors. But that's the reality, in which we live.
Okay. We've come to the end of our hour. Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State. Thanks for coming into our AIM studio to talk politics.
Much.
And we look forward to having you back again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. We had help in Ames from Jason Burns today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Remember, our silent drive is still going on. Over 82,000 raised so far. We've got a goal of 325,000. We want to do it without interrupting program. Won't you help us? Wouldn't that be great to achieve that goal without interrupting program? You can help by going to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.